There you go. Wouldn't it be great if this worked? Okay, let's look. So Lewis explained the constitution is the nature, that single, double, triple, and the sequence of bonds, toe bone connected to the ankle bone or whatever, foot bone, ankle bone. So what's connected to what and how it's connected, whether it's single, double, or triple. So from the electron number, you go to the valence number, and also there are unshared pairs, which is a new idea with Lewis. So here are various atoms showing their valence electrons. And we can have a valence of 1, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1. So you can have ammonia, for example, where we share pairs with this tetrahedral octet. But why? Why is it an octet? Why not a sestet? Yeah?
Because if you have an octet, with each one of the electrons in the S and P...
What's S and P? Well, we're way in the future. S and P, we know nothing from S and P.
The electrons will be spin paired unless it's more stable.
What?
The electrons will be spin paired unless it's more stable.
Well, you're going way beyond what was it. You're getting into stuff that's not going to happen for another 20 years after Lewis. Right? This is Lewis structures. Why S and why P? But we'll get to that later. Let's not do it now. Okay, and... why do you have just a pair for hydrogen and helium? Why not an octet or whatever for that them as well? Okay, Lewis didn't say anything about that. Okay, let's look at how you'd use Lewis things for HCN. Okay, so you have carbon with its four. You bring in a hydrogen and a nitrogen, and you can pair things up as shown, and you can draw it that way. But actually, Lewis drew lines for normal shared pair bonds, but the thing he added was writing a colon to be an unshared pair. Okay, so so Lewis had that idea. Okay, or ammonia. You bring in three hydrogens and have an unshared pair. Or borane, you bring in three hydrogens and you have BH3. Now here's something new from Lewis, right? You can take the NH3 and the BH3 and put them together using the pair from NH3 to share with boron and get a new bond. So you can have this molecule. So you can have the ammonia molecule, the borane molecule, but you can also have amine borane, right? Okay, now here's a puzzle though. This Lewis couldn't do. If you take two BH3s where you don't have the unshared pair, it turns out that you can dimerize that to B2H6. And in fact, it's quite favorable. It's worth 40 kilocalories per mole, half as much as a normal sigma bond. But what's the glue that holds this together if there's no unshared pair? And we'll get to that when we get to lecture 16, but you'll have to hold on for a while. Okay, now something else that this allows you to do, drawing these Lewis structures, is to do bookkeeping to write what are called formal charges. Right? So, and for that purpose, this is not necessarily where real charges are in the molecule, though it might be. Okay, but each atom you assign, just for bookkeeping purposes, a half interest in the shared pair of electrons. Okay, so you just arbitrarily divide it down the middle, one to each. Okay, then you can, if you look at this, you'll notice that pair that's between boron and nitrogen, they both came from nitrogen, but now half of it, for bookkeeping purposes, is assigned to boron. And that means that if you count up the protons and electrons that are assigned for bookkeeping purposes to each atom, the nitrogen is positive because it lost one of its electrons. And by the same token, what else? Boron's going to be negative, right? So if you have tetravalent nitrogen, the fourth bond was formed by sharing its pair and giving up half interest, at least for bookkeeping purposes, right? So tetravalent nitrogen is positive, and by the flip side of that, tetravalent boron is negative. Okay, so you would draw it that way. Now, is that real? Do you really have positive charge on nitrogen and negative charge on boron, or is this just something for bookkeepers? Okay, so you can define what's called the surface potential. for a molecule. Now you go to what, first you need the surface for a surface potential. The surface potential is the energy of a proton when it's on the molecular surface. A proton comes in from outside and goes onto the molecular surface without changing anything about the molecule, and you wonder what energy would that proton have. If it were in a region of positive charge, it would have a high energy. If it were in a region of negative charge, it would have a low energy. Right? So first you need to know where the molecular surface is, and there are programs, we'll talk about this a little later, that decide where the surface of a molecule is. Right? It's not like it's enameled, right? But anyhow, there's a thing you call defined as the surface. And you see that if you then color the surface according to the energy that a proton would have if it were on there, you find part of it is blue, and the bluest part is plus 25 kilocalories per mole, high energy. So what kind of charge is in that region on the molecule if a proton is going to be high in energy when it's there? So it's positive there, and by the same token, it's negative on the other side, minus 41. So that, you see, is what we said up here, or what Lewis said, that the nitrogen is positive and the boron is negative, right? So nitrogen indeed bears a positive charge and the boron bears a negative charge. We're not convinced that it'll always work that way, but at least Lewis succeeded in that respect. Okay, so Lewis explained the pentavalent nitrogen, that actually it's a tetravalent nitrogen, therefore plus, and so it forms a salt with chloride minus, and you all knew that from high school. Okay, now suppose you take an amine, you can share its pair with oxygen and get a compound called an amine oxide. That's a functional group, an amine oxide, and it's plus on nitrogen and minus on oxygen. By the same token, you can take a sulfide, and you can add an oxygen and get a sulfoxide. Or you can add another oxygen and get a sulfone. Or indeed, although these are rare and not observed very often, you can add a third oxygen and get a peroxysulfone or a persulfone. Now, what else might you imagine? You could just keep doing it and put 38 oxygens across there if you had a name for it, right? But that doesn't work. But it's not obvious from this why it shouldn't work if it worked up to this point. Okay, so these are things we're going to have to address later on. You could consider this either success or failing of Lewis structure, right? It's a success because it predicts these things that exist. It's a failing because it also predicts equally well you could have 38 oxygens in a row. Okay. Now, there are some problems for you to drill with. We drew the Lewis dot structure for HCN. I just did that a couple slides ago. Do it for HNC in that geometric order with nitrogen in the middle. Okay, and see how many structures you can draw for that. And also for HCNO. Right? And for this one, put the CNO in all six orders, right? CNO, OC, ONC, NOC, OCN, and all the permutations, right? And also, put the CNO in a ring, right? And then the hydrogen could be here, here, or here. And try drawing Lewis structures for that and see what you get for charges and whether it's possible. Yeah? But the H could be at either end. So there are 12 molecules. Okay? There are only 6 molecules because you put the H on one end with CNO, then that's the same as putting the H on the other end with O, N, C, or whatever. Okay? So there's 6 of them. And start memorizing the functional groups, because on the first hour exam, I always put something that you get a few points for knowing the names of the functional groups and how to draw them. And here they are, the ones, I mean, there are a zillion functional groups, but these are the ones that are important for our purposes. So the simplest thing is an alkane, and arguably it's not even functional. But then these others are functional groups, and you can see them there drawn with a sort of Lewis structure than just without the unshared pairs, and then in a very abbreviated form, which is what we would use most often. And there are some which are called conjugated, which have more than one of these simple functional groups in them. So those are the ones that you'll have to know for our present purposes, right? And this, you know, this course has the reputation, I mean, organic chemistry, of being a thing where you cram it all in, right, and memorize things. We don't memorize very many things in here, but this is something that you just got to know. So there you are. Okay, now, equilibrium versus resonance. How many of you have heard of resonance? Okay, now, resonance is a really funny thing. So here we've drawn a Lewis structure for HCNO. N positive, O minus. Right? Now, it's great it has all octets. If you find out every atom has an octet, except for some reason the hydrogen has only a pair. Right? But unfortunately, it has charge separation, because that's sort of defined to be bad, to have to separate charges rather than have things neutral. Atoms neutral. Okay. Now, you can get rid of that by shifting that pair of electrons from here, being only on the oxygen, to being shared between oxygen and nitrogen. Then you put, this member was formed from a pair on nitrogen being shared with oxygen. If we also shared a pair from oxygen with nitrogen, then that would balance that out. It wouldn't be any charges anymore. We could get rid of that. Okay? We could get rid of the charge separation, but what would the problem be? Yeah. Nathan? Yeah. It wouldn't be an octet on nitrogen anymore. It'd have too many electrons. Okay, but you could shift electrons from that bond onto carbon to get this structure. Okay? And then you have an octet on nitrogen, and there's an octet on carbon. Everything looks fine except for what? Now it's charge separated. You can't get there from here. Right? You can't draw a structure, a Lewis structure, that satisfies both things. Okay, so, and notice incidentally that when you draw a curved arrow in organic chemistry, what you mean is moving a pair of electrons without moving the nuclei. So when you draw a curved arrow, that's what you're read to mean. That may not be what you meant, but that's the way people are going to understand what you drew. So you better use it the right way, because otherwise you won't be saying what you wanted to say. Okay, and furthermore, this bottom one, that's a poorer sight. Because if you're going to have negative charge, you'd rather have it on oxygen than on carbon, for some reason. We'll get to that reason later. But I don't think you're surprised at that, are you? No. Okay, but are there geometric structural implications of these structures? The one on the top looks like the nitrogen might be closer to carbon, because it's triple bonded to carbon, only single to oxygen. Whereas here it's double, so the nitrogen might be about halfway between carbon and oxygen. Okay? So let's draw a curve that shows what the energy of this would be as we move the nitrogen back and forth from being on the left here to being in the middle here. Now it might look like this, that say it's lowest on the left. Why is this better? Because the charge is on oxygen rather than on carbon. So maybe this is lower, this is a little bit higher, and it'll click maybe. It can be one or it can be the other. And if you shift back and forth, you have to go up in energy before you go down. So it'll click back and forth, right? That might be the way it is. If that's so, there are two structures. It's called a double minimum, for obvious reasons. Two different structures, right? Each of which exists, right? But it might be that the energy doesn't look like that when you plot it according to the position of the oxygen. It might be that it looks like that. That it's a single minimum, right? And lowest in energy when it's neither here nor halfway between, but someplace in between it. Right? That might be the way nature really has it. And if that's so, it means that our notation, when we say it should be either this or this, is too simplistic. It's a failure of the notation. Right? The true structure is somewhere between these two, not one or the other. And that's what resonance is. Resonance is when the Lewis method of notation fails and the truth is between two things. So, for example, the geometry is between, or the charge distribution is between. right? So drawing a single structure doesn't tell you the truth. You have to take some kind of an average of two structures. That's what resonance is, right? So the choice between resonance and the first case where you have clicks, there are two minima, that's an equilibrium. It can be here or here. It goes back and forth from one to the other. But if it's a single minimum and it's here, actually, and doesn't click back and forth, that's called resonance. And so it must be based, the choice has to be based on experimental facts. You have to find out whether it clicks or whether it has one structure or some better theory than Lewis to tell you which way it should be to distinguish the single from the double minimum. So for equilibrium, you draw two arrows because it can be this or it can go to that or it can come back. But for resonance, you use a double-headed arrow, which means it's actually some mixture of those two. It's in between. There was a better name for this originally. The better name was mesomerism. M-E-S-O. You know what meso means as a prefix? Yeah? Henry? Pardon me? In between, like Mesopotamia is between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, right? So saying mesomerism said it was in between. That's really a clearer name for this phenomenon than resonance is. But it didn't catch on, unfortunately. Okay, so there are two real species. Here there's one real species, but two reasonable structural formulas, but neither of them is exactly correct. Okay, so it's a failure of simplistic notation. And typically, when you have that, the molecule is unusually stable. There's what's called resonance stabilization. Right? And unusual, when I say unusual, what you should wonder is compared to what? What's usual? How do you know if you measure this that it's unusual? And we'll get to that later on too. Okay, so here's a case of here are questions of equilibrium versus resonance. So this is a carboxylic acid, a functional group, as you'll learn when you start memorizing this. A few of you already know it, I'm sure. So here hydrogen is attached to this oxygen, that's a single bond, and this oxygen is closer to the carbon, that's a double bond. But you could imagine breaking this hydrogen away and attaching it to the other oxygen instead, in which case this bottom oxygen would be a single bond and the top would be a double bond. This isn't the thing flopped over, because the two oxygens are different atoms. I mean, they're identical in the sense they have the same number of protons and so on, but they're not the same atom. It could be attached to either of the two, right? Now, in that case, it turns out that that's an equilibrium. The hydrogen can go back and forth, and it clicks. It's one structure or the other structure. But how about if you take the hydrogen off and have this thing that's called a free radical, where the hydrogen with its electron went away and the oxygen has only one of the electrons in the electron pair, like this. Now, it could be this one or it could be that one. Is that an equilibrium? Does that click back and forth? That turns out to be a much more subtle question, which wasn't understood until a few tens of years ago, like about 1970 or 80. Right? And it turns out that it's not two species, that this is one species, and the true geometry is not this, but this. Right? They're the same distance. You can draw Lewis structures in two different ways, but the truth is in between. It's not that the double bond is short and the single bond is long. They're both the same to both oxygens. Right? So this is just one nuclear geometry. Now, how do you know this? There's evidence from a technique called electron paramagnetic resonance that I'm not going to go into, but I'll tell you that there is resonance that shows that there is evidence that in the bottom case it's one species, and in the top it's two species. Or, if you put an extra electron on and get the carboxylate anion, that one turns out to be a single species too. So you use the double-headed resonance notation, and evidence for that comes from infrared spectroscopy, which we won't talk about till next semester. But there is evidence that it's that way. But that the answers to this, whether it's a double minimum or a single minimum, is in the region of lore. Right? It's not something you can draw Lewis structures and figure out which way it's going to be. You can figure out what the alternatives are, either it's a double minimum or a single minimum, but to know which is which, you have to do some kind of experiment, like electron paramagnetic resonance, or IR. And that's going to take time. Oxford English Dictionary defines lore as that which is learned, learning, scholarship, erudition. Also in recent use, applied to the body of traditional facts, anecdotes, or beliefs relating to some particular particular subject. So that has to accumulate. You can't figure that out at the start, and you don't expect to know it now, right? So a lot of the things we talk about in this course are lore. Other things are fundamental theory. And you can't, the theory things we talk about, you can hope to master as we go along, right? But the lore will seep in through lab and reading and so on. So don't expect to know everything at the beginning. It takes time. Okay, now, in talking about resonance, there's a good textbook, one we used to use in this course, but it's out of print now, called, where it talks about that, and it says, there are empirical rules for assessing the relative importance of the resonance structures of molecules and ions. So you have some molecule that you could draw this structure, or you draw this structure, and the true properties are in between what you expect for this and this. But are they halfway in between? Are they closer to this one? Are they closer to this one? Right? How do you know where it should be? Well, this textbook gives some rules. It says resonance structures involve no change in the positions of nuclei. Only electron distribution is involved. And that's what I told you. Remember, these curved arrows that we were drawing move electrons, but they don't move the nuclei, these things, when you're talking about resonance structures. In fact, the electrons don't truly move. It's just in your pictures where you drew the lines moves. The electrons know where they want to be. It's the you that doesn't know where they want to be. So it's not that it's our depiction of the electron distribution changes, not the true electron distribution. So that's a minor fault in this definition. Rule two, structures in which all first row atoms have filled octets are generally important. And I said that it's good to have octets. However, resulting formal charges and electronegativity differences can make appropriate non-octet structures comparably important. And rule three is, the more important structures are those involving a minimum of charge separation, particularly among atoms of comparable electronegativity. Structures with negative charges assigned to electronegative atoms may also be important. And actually, without talking about it, we applied these rules a few slides ago. Right? But look carefully at this. It says, generally important. A true rule would say, always important. Right? Generally, how do you know whether it's this time or some other time? Right? Or it says, however, right? And it says, can make. It doesn't say does make. It says it can make it. Or down here, particularly among atoms. Okay? Or may also be important. Right? So these are not rules. Right? These are this is a realization of lore. If you already know what the facts are from having done experiment, then you come back to say, aha, this is important, or this is one of the cases where it's not important, or something like that. But you know the answer before you apply your rules, right? That's not quite fair. So a lot of people get frustrated by trying to apply these rules, right? And find some place where it doesn't exist. But that's giving more authority to them than they should have. Right, so don't be frustrated. The theory we're going to talk about will be generally true, but still, it's going to have to be applied in the light of what we know to be facts. Because organic chemistry is still an empirical science. You have to do the experiments, and we'll talk about that more. So that's lore. Okay, and it says right at the top, empirical rules. These are not what Moses came down with from Sinai, right? This is empirical. Okay, so we can predict the constitution, that's the nature and sequence of bonds using these valence numbers, and reactivity we saw with unshared pairs, that tells us something about reactivity, or the ability of adding some more electrons that like boron had, and charge distribution worked more or less okay, at least in the case of NH3BH3. Let's look at another case, O2 and O3. Well, of course, O2 is no problem, we do that and we get a double bond. O3, and we draw it that way. O3, we could draw as a ring, or that equilateral triangle, and we'll draw it that way. Or we might draw it this way, and it would be an open structure, like that. And if we did that, we'd have to draw positive and negative charges if we were doing our bookkeeping. So, because trivalent oxygen is positive for the same reason that tetravalent boron is positive. Tetravalent nitrogen is positive, pardon me. So now, what is ozone's true structure? You either have to do an experiment, Or you have to use some theory that people will believe something better than Lewis structures. Okay? So, is it a ring or is it open? And if it's open, is it a double minimum so it'll click back and forth between these short, long, long, short? Or is it a symmetrical single minimum where the middle oxygen is halfway along? Now, unfortunately, for purposes of drawing pictures, this is a problem in four dimensions. Because to define a triangle, or a geometry among three things, you need the distance from this one to this one, this one to this one, and this one to this one. So you need three numbers to tell the geometry. And then you need a fourth number to say what the energy is, whether it's better or worse than something else. So if you want to make a plot of this, you have to have a plot that shows four dimensions. Right? Three distances and an energy. And that's not easy to do on a piece of paper, although there are ways of doing it. Right? So, if you've done a lot of graphing and so on, and I know you think you've done, but it might be helpful to look at this web page to be sure you can do all these problems, which show more than, they're plotting more than three dimensions. Right? So it gives you some tricks about how you can go about plotting many dimensions, and we'll use a number of these in the course. So I advise you to do that to get back in swing with graphing. Because it turns out that what people in this course actually, people ask how much math is there in there. There's not very little math in the course, but using graphs properly is really important, so be sure you're up to speed on that. But anyhow, here's a graph that does this problem, and it's based on energies that come from quantum mechanical calculations at a very high level that were done by Rudenberg and his colleagues. So now, talking about this, as we said, requires four dimensions, right? So it could be R1, R2, and this distance, or it could be this distance, and this angle. Those both specify the geometry. So they did it with an angle, and in order to be able to plot, they assumed it was symmetrical, that the energies of interest will be symmetrical. So they didn't take into account the fact that it might, the option that it might click back and forth, but then they did extra calculations to show that in fact it did not click back and forth. So these are the relevant structures, the ones that they plot. So now if you assume that R12 equals R23 here, right, now you have only two dimensions, what this distance is, which is the same as that one, and what that angle is. Right? So they make a plot where they put the central oxygen at 0, 0 of the coordinate system. And then if you tell where this atom is, you know where that atom is, right? Because it's symmetrical. And now, so you can do it, so you blow up that, we're going to look just at the position of that atom. Right? And here's the picture they drew. Right, and 0, 0 is down here someplace, right? That's where the other oxygen is. So this oxygen is going to be someplace in that box, and the other one is going to be in a box over here someplace symmetrical to that one. Right? But now we have to plot the energy. Right? We've gone from 3 to 2, so we can put it on a piece of paper, two dimensions. But how are we going to do the energy? Anybody got a way of plotting? That we can show a third dimension here? Yeah, Henry? Pardon me? A contour plot. Right? Like when you're hiking, the altitude comes by drawing lines that connect the same altitude, and then you can draw inside, 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 and it gets higher or gets lower. Okay, so that's what they did. Now, there are two structures they did were a ring, which has this oxygen in that position, and therefore this one in that position, that's here, or this open structure, where the terminal oxygen is down there, okay? And now they draw the contours, right? So you see there's a valley here, low energy, but there's also a valley here. But to get from this valley, you have to climb over a pass before you can go down. So is this resonance or is this equilibrium? It's equilibrium. It clicks back and forth. They're two structures. Okay. Now, one of the valleys is lower. This valley has more contours than that one. This valley is lower. So the open structure is the normal structure. But there is another structure that might have that might last for just a tiny amount of time if it's really cold and so on. Okay. And but then there's a pass between the two valleys, and its altitude will be very important because what will that determine? How easily it clicks back and forth, right? Whether you could put one in a bottle and keep it there, for example. Okay, and then there's a path. Now, there are all sorts of paths if you were hiking, right? You might want to hike up here to get a view and then hike here, or you might go like this and so on, right? But there's a well-defined path that probably no molecule actually takes to go from one place to the other. Right, but at least it's well defined, so we can talk about it. Where it crosses every contour at right angles, right, and that's what's called steepest descent. If you had dropped a bucket of water, that's the way it would run down the bottom of the valley, right? So you could take that steepest descent path, and now we could replot it so as not to have to do all this work, just showing the energy as you go along that particular path. The one that goes over the lowest possible pass, right? And there we do it that way. Okay, so often you abbreviate it this way in a case like that, where you just show the energy along the steepest descent path. So here's the ring up here, open form is down there, and a pass to click back and forth between it. It's a double minimum. Okay. And as I indicated before, they also showed that if you made those two distances different to the two oxygens, those were all higher in energy than these structures, so you don't have to worry about those. This is the way things would actually go. Okay, so is it a symmetrical single minimum? Yes. Okay. Now, what about the charge distribution that's predicted if you do Lewis bookkeeping here? If this is a resonant structure, double-headed arrow, what would you say about charge in the molecule? Yeah, Henry? Yeah, there'd be negative charge on the two... Wait, I didn't do this right. This negative sign should be over here, right? I drew it wrong. Okay, so there should be negative charge here and negative charge here and positive charge in the middle, and overall it should be neutral. Is that true? Is it like that? Is it plus on the middle and minus on the ends? Well, here's a quantum mechanical calculation of the lowest energy of O3, the lowest energy structure, and here's that surface potential we talked about, and you see it's blue, that is positive in the middle, and it's red, negative on the ends. But notice, it's interesting, it's here and here on the ends, not here, that it's negative. That you didn't get out of Lewis structures. But at least the idea that it's negative on the ends and positive in the middle is something good about Lewis structures for the resonance. So yes, it does more or less work. Okay, so charge distribution, at least qualitatively. Now, how about structures and distances, these Lewis structures you draw? How good is that at predicting geometry? We'll test that later in the semester, so be patient on that one. And it does more or less okay. And energy content, we'll test that later as well. And that's sort of more or less okay, but not good enough for our purposes. Okay, now, the Lewis dot structure attempts to provide a physical basis for valence rules on the basis of shared pairs. There's something new in it, which is that you get reactivity due to unshared pairs. Notice that means both hooks in the bond are coming from the same atom. Sort of interesting. And it's convenient for electron bookkeeping, and you can talk about molecular charge and these formal atomic charges, and it's qualitatively realistic, at least we've seen so in the case of O3, but we don't know that it's going to be generally true. And then there's this question of stability and resonance, and resonance is not such a... Remember, what really is hiding our ignorance. The fact that the way of drawing is not truly right. We have to use several pictures in order to get the correct idea. Okay, now, the question is, what's so great about octets? Why not have sestets or sets of 10 or something? And how bad are sestets? And how bad are structures that have formal charge separation? How many kilocalories per mole is that going to cost you? Or how bad is bad charge separation? Sometimes you can have better charge separation and worse charge separation. And this, these are tough problems. And in the wiki on 2007, one student wrote, "I have a question when drawing these structures. Is it more important to try to fill the octet or to have the lowest formal charge on as many atoms, especially carbon, as possible? And why?" Because we aren't saying anything yet about why. And that's what we hope to do over the coming weeks, is to say why things should be this way. And there's the further question, is it true? Are these Lewis structures the way things really are? Are there bonds? Are there pairs between atoms that are holding them together? Okay. And what's the force law? That's what Newton wanted to know, remember, that about connecting these things. That's a fundamental thing. Now, Earnshaw's theorem from 1839 is very important. He was a tutor at Cambridge, interested in physics. He became a cleric. He was actually a cleric already at this time. But he had this theorem in 1839 that had to do with the theory of light, which is, in systems governed by inverse squared force laws, could you name me an inverse square force law? Gravity, electrostatics, interaction of magnetic poles, essentially everything we know about is inverse squared. Everything we know about. There's some things that aren't, like quark interactions and so on, but most of the fundamental laws we know are inverse square. There can be no local minimum or maximum of potential energy. If you want something to sit here and be stable in that position, that means any direction you move it away, it goes up in energy. So it'll come back down, it'll always return. Okay? So it's a minimum of energy. But Earnshaw's theorem says that if the force laws are inverse squared, there can be no local minimum, or indeed no maximum, of potential energy. And you can see this very easily using Faraday's lines of force. You've seen things like this, right? The lines of force in magnets that go from one pole to the other. And they show the force that's put on a magnetic pole when it's in a particular region, right? And Faraday's idea was that you had these lines of force and they push a positive magnetic pole one way or the other. So plus repels plus, minus attracts plus. And the density of the lines tells you how strong the force is. The direction of the arrow shows the direction of the force, and the density of the lines show how strong the force is. There's young Michael Faraday, incidentally. He was mostly a chemist, but he did some very important things in physics. Now, so they show the magnitude of the force through the density of the lines. Okay, so now suppose you take a little area here and see how many lines go through it. That tells you how strong the force is to the right in that at that position, the center of that little area, right? Now, suppose you went further away. How about the density of lines when you get further away? Higher density, lower density? Dre, what do you say? You see what I'm saying? You take a certain area and see how many lines go through it. That's the density of lines per one square, whatever, centimeter. Okay? And now I pull the square centimeter further away. More lines or fewer lines going through it? Pardon me? Fewer? I couldn't hear what you said. Fewer lines. How many fewer? Suppose you move it twice as far away. How many fewer in this two-dimensional picture? Suppose you go twice as far away, how many fewer lines? Notice that if you go all the way around the circle, you get a certain number of lines. But as you go further away, the circle gets bigger. How much bigger does the circumference get if you double the radius? It doubles. So how about the density of the lines? How many lines go through a given distance along the... Half, right? So if you had this in two dimensions... Right? In flat land, the circumference proportional to the radius, so the force would be proportional to the line density, which is proportional to 1 over r. Okay? It would fall to half if you doubled r. Right? How about if you did it in three dimensions? Now it's the surface of a sphere, goes with the square of the radius, so now it's an inverse square force law. So if you have an inverse square force law, you can do this trick. right, of the lines of force. Lines of force will work in three dimensions for inverse square force laws. Okay, and works in 3D, they work only for inverse. If you have another kind of force law, you can't draw lines of force this way. Okay, so here's a zillion little charges, and we connect them up. And what we see is that the only places where it would be stable, where the lines converge, are where there's a charge. There's no place off someplace else where all the lines would converge. You see that idea? Only where there's a charge could something be stable. So that means you can't... You might imagine... Here you have a little ball, like one of those gilded pith balls, and its gravity's pulling it down. Charge it positive, put a ring here, or a triangle of positive charges that will repel it. You might imagine that there'll be some place where it will just sit there, repelled by these charges, and the repulsion gets stronger as it gets closer. To some point it'll balance gravity, and then the thing will just sit there. Did you ever see anything floating like that? Just sitting there? You can't, if the force laws are inverse squared, because of Earnshaw's theorem. He showed mathematically that you can't do that. If you have lines of force, you can't have something just sit there. But that means that charged nuclei can't just sit there if the electrical force is what's important. It contravenes Earnshaw's theorem. And now look at this, just to end. I realize we're... So systems governed by inverse squares for no local maximum or minimum of potential energy in free space. The only stationary points are saddle points. A saddle is where the energy would go down this way, but up.